All right, we live now.
All right, cool.
Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, running a little late. Let's just get started. Man's Word, where is that, Ross?
That's in the thread too. I think it's towards the middle, going towards the tail end. He's going in now. Let me just go to it from my phone. Give me
Talking about
one
the
second.
James Brown joint.
Say it again.
The James Brown joint.
Yep, that's the one.
All right, let me just pull it up on YouTube.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Baraka.
Welcome to real life.
You're trained as bodyguards. All right, VIPERS stands for Violence Intervention Protective Emergency Response System. You're trained as bodyguards. You're trained to make sure that people stay safe. This is the purpose of our organization, for over 20 years. And this is what we do.
For well over a decade, Detroit has been struggling with retaining their cops. In response, an avalanche of private security companies have rushed in.
The reason why you're dressed like this is to be very, very psychologically impressive. So when they see how you're dressed, they think you're serious, because you are serious.
After the city filed for bankruptcy in 2013, budget and pay cuts have pushed cops towards better paying police work outside of the city.
Clear!
Clear, sir!
All right, that was excellent. What you're seeing is the beginning of an entire new industry, which is threat management services. We are literally leading the way in a paradigm shift in safe public and corporate protection. My right leg went out, my right hand goes up. Two, three. This is our tactical training facility. This is called the Grid. This is where we store our vehicles. This is our tactical boat. These are our motorcycles. These motorcycles allow us to get to situations very quickly. This custom boat allows us to get into shallow water. It's also very fun and jumps over waves, and people enjoy riding in it.
Dale Brown, an ex-Army paratrooper, began teaching his own brand of self-defense in the early 90s. He started his own security company in 2000.
So this is a Detroit fair fight, 4-on-1. Keep your knees bent.
Brown says his 60-person Viper force has more than 5,000 private citizens as clients, along with 100 businesses. Altogether, the company brings in about $2 million a year.
This is a community that pays us to protect their community, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No home invasions, no murders, no rapes, and no armed robberies whatsoever have been done here. So police use law enforcement, and what we do is use bodyguarding tactics to prevent predation. Our goal is to create conditions where violence does not occur. We deter violent criminal behavior by projecting strength. So our vehicles have all white strobe lights. Our vehicles are black and chrome. There's a strong sense that there is a strong organization that's protecting these people. And then we speak to people very respectfully.
You have any weapons on you right now? Walk with me over here, please.
And so we have all these different ways of showing that this is just not a good place to be a predator. And it's all nonviolent. And we're growing. So more and more people, they want us in their communities.
I think in areas in Detroit where you have these very affluent communities right in the heart of the ghetto, if you will, more and more people are utilizing services like threat management. They've shown up whenever I've called them. And in fact, their response time is so much greater than the Detroit Police Department that without them, I would not be as comfortable.
Private security is booming in Detroit. The largest contractor has reported 25% year-over-year growth since the city's bankruptcy.
Do we think that security guards that are visible in neighborhoods deter crime? Yes. Can security guards replace police officers? No. The effectiveness of a police department is solely dictated by the trust relationship they've garnered in the community. I was appointed as police chief almost 6 years ago. The city was facing bankruptcy. There were neighborhood police stations that were closed. There was a strong belief that some of these security companies were more effective than the police department.
But it wasn't just because of the city's bankruptcy. In 2003, the federal government accused the Detroit PD of unconstitutional conduct, including excessive use of force and illegal detentions. They were under federal oversight for 13 years.
But I think the relationship today is much better than it was, say, 6 years ago. We are absolutely turning the corner.
Although the department has improved, Detroit still has the second worst crime rate in the country.
So this location, this is one of our clients. If you set up security service with us, we respond to your home. 10 minutes, $10. So when we respond to your home, it's a $10 charge for the first 10 minutes. Every minute after that is $1 a minute. The main purpose for this is so they feel safe when they close up. What you could have is a person trying to hide next to the car when they close up and then attack them when they get to their vehicles. So they start clients leaving, we wait outside while they lock up the property, and then we'll sit in front of the building to wait till the store closes.
See, the one thing about policing in America is the police are the public and the public are the police. meaning it's supposed to be a partnership. It was never supposed to be about who can afford the most police and go out and hire your own police.
The byproduct of your purpose is that people prosper, and then we charge them a bunch of money so we can have things.
A police department is answerable to the public. They're answerable to the mayor. They're answerable to their city council. And a private police firm, depending upon how big it is, it's answerable to a board of directors.
So it's up to you guys to remember your functional purpose, because if you'll do that, then this has a great opportunity for you, for all of us, for all of us to make the world a better and safer place. Clear?
Yes.
Just making this for my friends out there so they'll know the difference between what is wild lettuce opium, which you're looking here, these tall broadleaf plants, and dandelions. See a lot of thumbnails with people calling these dandelions wild lettuce opium, but they're not. This is the real deal. And I just want to give a little testimonial that I suffered for 10 weeks this year with a headache, and it was really horrific. And I ended up having to go to the hospital, the emergency room, to get some painkillers. And of course, you know, they're real tight with the painkillers now. And they didn't want to give me but 9 of them, and there were some Percocets. The one they gave me at the hospital really worked. It's probably a good strong one. I think they gave me some placebos at the pharmacy, or some really weak stuff that really didn't work. And so I had to basically just, you know, every 3 days maybe do a Percocet to kind of wean myself off that headache. And they stopped working after about, you know, the fourth or fifth one. Maybe they were only getting rid of maybe 15% of the pain. And so I remember I had 2 grams left of some wild lettuce opium that I had bought from Latvia on eBay, and I'm going to be putting the link there. Here's some that has just, in one of the grow bags I've got, it just took off. I mean, it absolutely filled this whole bag up. So I'll be growing these, and they grow all around the property, but see, there's even some over there. There's some over there in the corner, some little ones. So anyways, I'm going to be growing these and extracting the tar from them. So I just wanted to point this out to you that this is the best thing that ever happened to me, was doing the wild lettuce opium, because it completely killed the headache with one dose. So wild lettuce opium is more powerful than opium, more powerful than morphine, as is claimed in many of the advertisements selling it. So I would just, I'm giving a positive testimonial. I'll be, you know, harvesting as much as I can and making my own extract this year. And just want to also let you know that plantain is in full growth right now. These big, beautiful leafy greens. It's a very powerful medicine as well for a lot of problems, including indigestion, irritable bowel, skin conditions, all sorts of stuff. But it's time to keep an eye on both of these. Actually, you could actually be harvesting some of this plantain right now, but I would wait until the wild lettuce opium grows up and starts to flower. As soon as it starts to flower, I'd pull them up by the roots, wash them off, and then go ahead and cook them down. There's plenty of videos on YouTube explaining the process. So just wanted to chime in with a absolutely positive testimonial about wild lettuce opium. It is beautiful stuff. It really works. It ended my headache completely after 10 weeks of misery. So I'm sold. I'm going to be harvesting as much as I can this year, and I would encourage you to as well, because this is way better than any synthetic narcotics. I mean, you know, let's face it, the crap they're selling us is just a shitty imitation of opium. I mean, when I was growing up, we had opium. Paregoric is what we had as kids. I remember as a little boy out in Mississippi on a cattle ranch out there getting paregoric, and how wonderful it was to get rid of, like, the pain that you had for cutting teeth and things like that, or other pain. just the pain of life lately, actually. But anyways, just going to end with my beautiful California poppies here in the backyard, and wish y'all well. Take care of yourselves. Just it's a waste of time going to the doctor. It's better you treat yourself and find these old natural remedies. I mean, you know, Mother Earth put these things, Gaia Sophia put these plants here for our benefit. And, you know, it's our duty, our responsibility to educate ourselves and treat ourselves with the beautiful plants that she's given us. Okay. Take care, y'all. Much love.
He said life pains.
Your enemy totally. Law 15. Crush your enemy totally. All great leaders since Moses have known that a feared enemy must be crushed completely. Sometimes they have learned this the hard way. If one ember is left alight, no matter how dimly it smolders, a fire will eventually break out. More is lost through stopping halfway than through total annihilation. The enemy will recover and will seek revenge. Crush him, not only in body, but in spirit. So I'm going to skip over both the transgression and observance of the law. The two Chinese stories that are hard to storytell. If you're curious enough, you need to buy the book, read the book. In Chinese history, there's a lot of examples of enemies who were left alive and ended up returning to cause some type of chaos for a certain individual. And so a moral of kind of Chinese history became crush the enemy. And it's what's talked about in Sun Tzu's book, The Art of War, another very famous, world-renowned Chinese leader, philosopher. Your enemies wish you ill. There is nothing they want more than to eliminate you. If, in your struggles with them, you stop halfway, or even three-quarters of the way, out of mercy or hope of reconciliation, you only make them more determined, more embittered, and they will someday take revenge. The solution? Have no mercy. Crush your enemies as totally as they would crush you. Now, reading that, the first thought that comes to my mind, I know it comes to a lot of people's minds, would be, that's very aggressive. That's very extreme. And initially you would think, how do I apply that to my life? Like, crush my enemy totally. Like, I don't want to kill anybody. I'm not no Chinese leader. I'm not about to take over a country. No, we're not. That's not most people's goals. But what's a competitive environment that you see yourself in that you might need to defeat the person you're competing against totally? First one comes to mind is sport, athletics. Whatever sport it is, you see so many times where in games and matches, a team will come back because of complacency in the last portion of the game. Happens all the time in basketball, happens all the time in the NBA. So the point is, don't take your foot off the pedal and crush your enemy totally. Like, keep going, keep pushing, no matter how much time is left on the clock. Michael Jordan is the perfect example of this. He's not in this book, but he's what comes to mind, and I think a lot of people can resonate with him. He was a true competitor. He never gave up, no matter how much time was left on the clock. It was relentless. He had that mindset to keep attacking. He never gave up. And he literally, this is the law he would abide by. He crushed his enemy totally. He had no remorse for them. He wanted to win. Now, as a competitive, if you don't play sports or not in athletics, that's okay. But many people have, and they can understand that mindset. But what if you're in business? What if you need to make a certain amount of money than the other guy next to you? You gotta beat him. You have to crush him. And whether it's a mentality over an actual physical crushing, like, you don't actually have to do anything that is morally unjust towards him in order to crush him. You can just have that mentality to crush him, like to beat him. Again, not physically, but mentally, emotionally, you have to beat him. You have to outwork him, you have to outsmart him. And Robert notes in the book a little anecdote that a lot of people can relate to if they're religious and if they've read the Bible. It shows that this idea has been ancient as the Bible. So Moses, when he parted the Red Sea for the Jews to all come with him, he let the water flow all back in, for his enemies behind him, the Egyptians, who were all pursuing him. So they were all defeated by massive amounts of water because Moses needed to crush his enemy totally. Realize this, in your struggle for power, you will stir up rivalries and create enemies. There will be people you cannot win over who will remain your enemies no matter what. But whatever wounds you inflicted on them, deliberately or not, do not take their hatred personally. Just recognize that there is no possibility of peace between you, especially as long as you stay in power. If you let them stick around, they will seek revenge, as certainly as night follows day. To wait for them to show their cards is just silly. By then, it will be too late. I feel like you have to look beyond, like, you just have to keep looking beyond the initial title of this law. It's like, don't do shit half-assed. Don't do shit halfway. Like, crush your goals. Crush the things you want to achieve. The action you need to take, destroy it. Like, just fucking... Like, carpe diem, seize the day. Seize the moment. Like, when you need to take massive action towards lofty goals that are far away, you need to attack every single day. That's your enemy. The day is your enemy. Because your day is running out. This life is running out. Now, your life is your enemy and your friend, but it's your enemy because you need to destroy it. You need to attack it every single day in order to get the things you want, in order to be happy, successful, whatever life you want. You can't do shit half-assed and expect high results. Everybody knows that already. I'm just repeating it through this law. Point is, attack. Image. A viper crushed beneath your foot but left alive will rear up and bite you with a double dose of venom. An enemy that is left around is like a half-dead viper that you nurse back to health. Time makes the venom grow stronger. Reversal. This law should very rarely be ignored, but it does sometimes happen that it is better to let your enemies destroy themselves. When you have someone on the ropes then, but only when you are sure they have no chance of recovery, you might let them hang themselves. Let them be the agents of their own destruction. The results will be the same, and you won't feel as bad. And you won't look as bad either. Attacking and being so aggressive to crush your enemy can give you a certain reputation among the meek. If it's your enemy, it means this person doesn't like you. So, to be lenient would give the other person room to operate and maneuver. So, rather than let them plot revenge around you, isn't it wiser to crush them? Don't let your guard down. Simply crush them. Law 15, crush your enemies totally.
Second precinct.
I remember that.
He used to have individuals that want to come up from the south and up to the north and they stay over there until he get them a job.
That's right. He got them on their feet. That's
so
right.
He recruiting them from down south.
That's right. I remember that. It was three hotels there.
Right. It was a hotel.
Yeah. The buildings are still standing.
I know.
Yeah, but it was three hotels there that he would bring them up and stash them in there, make sure they was
get
comfortable and whatnot, made sure they was comfortable and whatnot, and then got them a job.
Right. Because they had some of the, some family members in Harlem had family members in the South that wanted to come to Harlem.
Here. That's right.
So they'll go to Bumpy.
That's
and
right.
Bumpy, what he'll do, he'll send them the money for them to get
up
make
here.
A trip up here.
That's right.
On Greyhound Trailway bus.
That's
and
right.
Put them in a hotel on 135th Street.
That's right.
Get them
that's
some clothes, right. Give them some money.
Money.
And then he'll set them up in,
a job.
One of the spots.
That's right. My father, was
connected with
my father was a butcher before he went into the post office. And it was a butcher shop on 116th Street and Lenox Avenue.
All right.
And my father would go in there and work and do all that. You remember that butcher shop. I know you do. And my father would go in there and do the butcher work and whatnot. And come home. He got all the chicken backs. Mm-hmm. You get for $2, you got so many chicken backs, you got tired of eating chicken backs. Mm-hmm. You understand? you got chicken backs.
Yes.
And they would bring them home, stew the chicken backs and whatnot. And that's where they got that 3-day pot thing. They made a 3-day pot, which was a whole lot of vegetables and stuff in a pot, big pot with meat in it and whatnot. And you ate that for 3 days. Mm-hmm. But each day it tastes different because they would put a little different kind of seasoning in it.
All right.
So it was always good. Yeah, uh-huh. Stay with the onions and stuff, man. Oh, mm-hmm. What?
You know what just came?
I still do that.
Yes, sir. You know what just came to my mind?
What?
May Pab rest in peace, right?
Yeah.
He was upstate with Bumpin' though.
Oh, yeah.
He told me, he said that he used to be up in Clinton, he was in Clinton with Bumpy,
right.
And
my Uncle
Hollywood Harold.
And my Uncle Chisholm, Edward right. Chisholm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was all together.
He said, and they told that's him right. How to
together.
How to invest his money.
That's right.
Okay.
That he had when he come home.
In. Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm.
That was something.
Definitely.
Okay. Man, let me tell you something.
So tell me how you used to recruit people, bring them up from the South. Tell me how you used to recruit people and the kids here and how they used to have them run the numbers.
Okay. What he did, just like the brother was saying, he would go to some family that's already up here, and they would say, Bumpy, I'm going to bring so-and-so and so up. And he would bring them up, and on 135th Street, he had these three hotels right across from the precinct.
He owned the hotels?
Yes.
Okay.
And he would let them stay there until he could get him a job. And guess what? He would always get him a job on the concourse in the Jew's house, because that way they can hear.
Yeah.
He know what they saying.
Yeah.
It took them a long time to figure that out. They didn't understand how, why this man here know everything we getting ready to do. You understand? And it took them a long time before they figured out, wait a minute. They came from Bumpy's employment place.
So what was the significance of having them in the house? Were they other gangsters who he had in the
yes.
House?
Okay. They was up there, Jewish gangsters and stuff. But
the
maid would hear what they's talking the about.
Hmm? Dutch Schultz was Jewish from the Bronx.
Yeah, Dutch Schultz in it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And the maids would hear what they're saying and whatnot. And then she come back, they tell Bumpy. He said, okay. You understand? So he had him. He knew everything he was getting ready to do or wanted to do. You understand? He set it up so beautiful. It was so beautiful. Oh, it was. It'll never happen again in 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Not in 100 years, 1,000 years. I don't think that ever. No one man could do what he did today.
Nah.
Can't do it.
That's right.
It's impossible because you know why? Because
right.
Bumpy brought unity with everything he did.
Right.
He made sure that everybody ate.
Mm-hmm.
You could not starve in Harlem unless you just wanted to starve.
Right.
You understand? You come out in the morning with no money in your pocket and you go back in right.
Mm.
You understand? And if that means if you don't go back in right, that means you don't want no money.
Right.
Something's wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? He made sure everybody eat.
You're right.
Mafiosos at all?
No.
Nope. Was he totally protected?
No, they didn't
miss him. No,
he had static. Yeah, that was nothing.
Yeah, look, Bumpy Coty, my man,
okay.
90 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
Told me when we was, you know, behind the wall that he came up here, right, mm-hmm. when they was fighting. I don't know if it was the Italians or either Dutch Schultz. Most likely it was Dutch Schultz.
Schultz.
I right. said most likely.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure, so I'm not going to state something that I don't know. But Coty said that he came up from South Carolina, Charleston, Bumpy cousin, and they gave him a party.
Right.
Exposed him to women and gave him $100,
yeah.
a 38, a brand new suit, and all of that.
That's right.
And
that's
after the party, or either after the weekend party,
yeah.
he got in the car with Bumpy. Bumpy told him.
Yeah.
Right? That, look, you see all that you had? The only way we're going to keep that is to take care of them people that's trying to take it away from me.
And that's it.
And look, he drove him to the spot that's where right. he wanted him to take care of business.
That's right.
And Cody got out the car.
Yep.
Took care of the business.
Yes, sir.
And stepped off. And he said that was over on 116th Street in Pleasant Avenue that's over that right. way.
Yeah. Mm. Now, here's you something know? They don't tell you about. When he brought up how Bumpy got those dudes out of
Charleston.
San Quentin.
Yeah.
I forgot their names. They were some, there was three brothers. It, they came here. Palisades Park was in New Jersey.
Yeah, right across the river.
They're the ones that killed Dutch
Shields
on Bumpy's orders.
Which three brothers?
The dudes that came, that Bumpy got out of San Quentin prison. They got in the boat, and Bumpy drove them out to sea. But they told Bumpy, whatever you want us to do, we'll do if you get us out of here when Bumpy was leaving. And that's why Bumpy did that. They went, and they came here, and they went to Palisades and walked from Palisades in the snow. They wouldn't take a car. And walked to Newark, New Jersey. Went up on there and killed what's his name again?
Dutch
Schultz.
So wait.
They took him out.
The guys that escaped from Alcatraz.
That's right.
That they don't know whatever happened to him.
Yeah, they said he died. They don't want nobody to know that a black man was able to do that.
Those were the guys that hit Schultz.
That's right.
Wow.
My father told me that. He said they walked from Palisades all the way to Newark in the snow. Hit him, came walked back in the snow, and when they got back to Palisades, the car was waiting for him and brought him across the George Washington Bridge.
Right, and in regards to what you had, the question that you asked, I was told that when he had his crew members patrolling the borders of Harlem to make sure that they don't come in, some of them slipped in one time, and he was leaving one of the, you know, he's a patronized night spots by himself.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was leaving going home one night and because he had got shot up.
Mm-hmm.
But the paramedics in Harlem Hospital loved Bumpy.
Yeah.
So when they found out, they said Bumpy is shot. They ran out there, the nurses and all of them, because he used to go into Harlem Hospital every 2 weeks. And he used to stay in there all day long playing chess and checkers with the senior citizens, and then he used to go to the maternity ward, and the new mothers that's giving birth to children, he used to get them $100 and a dozen of roses and become the godfather of their child.
Of that child.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
I heard that when I was a kid, too.
Yeah, my father used to tell me that.
You know who we talking about?
Yeah.
You know who we talking about? A man, God, walking the planet Earth.
Yeah, he cared about people. He cared about
people. He cared. He was a king, and he cared about. And you, let me tell you, just like I said, you could not starve in Harlem unless you wanted to.
Not on his watch.
Not on his watch.
They told. I was told that he used to bring a basket of money once a week and sit it on the roof of the car on 116th for Lenox, off of Lenox, and give people that's down in their luck, $100 to $300 out of that basket full of money.
That's right.
To help the
straight. Here's something he used to do in 146th Street in the mornings. He used to say, who want to go to jail?
Right.
All the men that didn't have jobs said, I go to jail, Bumpy, I go to jail. Because at that time, numbers wasn't a felony.
Right. Mm-hmm.
All they had to do, the precinct just needed to put in laws. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? So they took them to jail, but what he would do, he would give the man $50 and give his wife $50.
If he was married.
Yeah, if he was married.
I hooked up.
You understand? That because Bumpy knew the man was going to mess up the money anyway.
He'd jerk the 100.
You understand?
If he was married.
He'd give the woman $50 and him $50, and they go to jail. Dudes be waiting for Bumpy to come around and say, let's go to jail.
That was the occupation for
That was a job.
It was a job.
So he had something going on with the police, too, then.
Yes.
Yes.
They were bodyguards.
Off.
Mr. Lester and them.
Yeah.
They were his bodyguards. You touch Bumpy in Harlem, you think the King Cole trio wouldn't be on your behind?
Who's the King Cole trio?
That was three black cops that nobody messed with.
Yeah.
Nobody.
Yeah, I heard about them.
All Bumpy had to do was like, and that was it. He was gone. Bye.
Did he ever bring Lucky up to Harlem?
No.
No.
That was before our time. That was in the 40s. Yeah. Early 40s.
Our time, no. Now, before that, I don't know.
Somebody told me that when Lucky Luciano, Dutch Schultz, and them was running the penny and nickel numbers, that they was living, they had an apartment on the first floor in the Dunbar houses on 7th Avenue. Somebody had told me that. I don't know. That building was there, I heard. Back then, right? The Dunbar?
Dunbar was a big time building.
Back in the, came in, I think, the 30s.
Yeah.
That was the first housing project.
Right.
You know what the Dunbar was?
Dunbar.
The Dunbar was where all of the black stars, movie stars and whatnot lived.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, all the Bessie Smith.
Like
all
courtyards.
Of
courtyards.
It was beautiful at a time.
Right.
It was beautiful. We, who lived outside of that, couldn't go in there.
Right.
Right, they had
you
security.
You chased out by the security.
Yeah. That's right.
When I was
growing up, they wouldn't let us in there.
I got chased by the security.
Plenty of times.
And I had a girlfriend in there. Karen Williams. Yeah. Michael Williams' brother.
I remember.
And Mickey's sister. Excuse me. And Mickey Williams.
Yeah, I remember.
Fine.
I remember.
And she turned around and passed away.
Now, in the book, you talked about, you know, the racism that your parents endured gave them a level of anger and they couldn't take it out on anyone but themselves. How did you see that kind of play out?
Well, in those days, there were men who came back from the army fighting for this country. And when they came back, they did not have equal citizenship. They, even though they saw their friends die or get wounded, etc., they could not go into the same restaurants as whites or ride on the same buses or have the same access to medical care. So there was an anger about that. And sometimes we took it out on each other, like the elements of pride were, you know, even though you were impoverished, the hat that you wore or the shoes that you wore or the jewelry that you had on or whatever, some of that carries over till today. But in those days, if you stepped on a man's shoes and scratched his brand new shoes, you could be stabbed or shot. Because that was what they had to say, this is who I am, and that you destroyed that, because self-esteem at that time was very low, and we were treated in a way as second-class citizens, and so we had to build our own sense of pride from the things that we could afford.
Well, I guess there was a situation where your dad got into a fight with a police officer.
My father was a very proud man. He took no insult of any kind, and we were riding, coming from getting some food, I think, at that time, and my father made an illegal U-turn, and the cops pulled him over, and he said, "Well, I'm sorry about that, you know." And they said something to the effect, "You should be sorry, nigga." And he said, you know, something to the extent, "Excuse me, but my family's in the car, so would you please be careful how you speak?" And the cop said something to the effect, "You know, who cares about you, monkeys or coons? Your family's a bunch of monkeys." My father got out of the car and punched the cop in the face, took his gun from him, and the second officer, he also punched. And he took both their guns and got back in the car, and he rode to the police station.
With their guns?
Yes. And told the police chief, my mother went in with him, that what had happened, and that he wasn't trying to hurt anybody, but he would not let anybody insult or disrespect his family. And the major thing that happened that was a shock to my sister and I was that the police chief said, I'm not charging you because I have a family too.
And it was a white police chief.
A white police chief. And that was unheard of, but they respected my father for taking up for his family.
I mean, taking a cop's gun is essentially a death sentence most times, mm-hmm. regardless of white, black, Mexican, right. Asian. Right. You take a cop's gun. And even really walking into a police station with a gun, period, is extremely dangerous.
Yes, but, you know, he wasn't pointing at anybody. He was surrendering himself.
Yeah.
Because he thought that they were going to do something to him or put him away. But when he told this story, the police chief said, he apologized to my father and said that no one should insult your family. And that's not what this department's about. And so that's what happened.
Did you run into those cops?
If you think about it, the things they say about black men are not valid. Right. You know, globally,
sure,
the biggest threat to humans are old white males. You know, if you really think about it, black men don't do anything to no one but themselves. You know, so when you get on the elevator, you have no reason to clench your purse. What we should do is clench our culture. You feel what I'm saying? Like, we're not the threat. But to make them feel better about what they do to people globally. And what I always do is I ask people, I said, you know, Native Americans are indigenous to this land. I said, but when the last time you seen a Native American in garb? Buffaloes are indigenous to this land. When the last time you seen a buffalo? Because white men killed them all. You know, you go just about anywhere on this globe, man, you look at the Tasmanian people, they literally don't exist anymore because of white men, but because they control history and they control the news and they control the magazines, they are able to forecast who they want to be the true threat. And perception is a motherfucker. And the sad thing is that we've bought into it. We actually believe that we're a problem. And the only reason why we hate ourselves the way that we hate ourselves is because most black people see themselves through the eyes of white people. They don't notice. That's why it's so easy to call each other niggas. We're nigger because we want to act like white men and white, like slave masters. Like, why would you want to call yourself the most wretched word that pertains to black people? Why would you want to call yourself a nigger? And we don't even know why we hate ourselves the way that we do. You know, most of the things that we do in fashion are to try to make us look like white folks.
I ain't no black.
Straighten our skin, straighten our hair. Our hair grows towards God. Grows towards the sun like a plant. Everything that dies grows towards the ground. And black folks do everything they can to kill them, to kill their hair. You know, and we are the closest thing to God.
Well, I am very pleased to see so many who have come out to always see for yourself, where you can hear for yourself and then think for yourself. Then you'll be in a better position to make an intelligent judgment for yourself. But if you form the habit of listening to what others say about something or someone, or reading what someone else has written about someone, somebody can confuse you and misuse you. So as Afro-Americans or black people here in the Western Hemisphere, you and I have to learn to weigh things for ourselves. No matter what the man says, you better look into it. An example of why it's so important to look into things for yourself. I was on a plane between Algiers and Geneva, and it just happened that two other Americans were sitting in the two seats next to me. None of us knew each other, and the other two were white, one a male, the other a female. And after we had been flying along for about 40 minutes, the lady, she says, could I ask you a personal question? I said, yes. She said, well, she had been looking at my briefcase, and she said, well, what does that X She says, what kind of last name could you have that begins with X? So I said, that's it, X. And she said, well, what does the M stand for? I said, Malcolm. So she was quiet for about 10 minutes. And she turned to me and she says, you're not Malcolm X. You see, we had been riding along in a nice conversation, like three human beings, you know, no hostility, no animosity, just human. And she couldn't take this. She said, well, you're not who I was looking for, you know? And she ended up telling me that she was looking for horns and all that, and for someone who was out to kill all white people, as if all white people could be killed. This was her general attitude, and this attitude had been given her, this image had been given her by the press. So before I get involved in anything nowadays, I have to straighten out my own position, and which is clear, I am not a racist in any form whatsoever. I don't believe in any form of racism. I don't believe in any form of discrimination or segregation. I believe in Islam. I'm a Muslim.
This message goes out for the people who try as much as they possibly can to help as many people as they can. And people keep stabbing you in your back. Don't stop helping people. You just have to be more selective in who you decide to help. Because you have to protect your spirit and your soul. I used to think I was hard as steel. I used to think I was cold, just cold-blooded. And I realized that I'm not. I do care. And that's what makes me special. Not the stuff that I am willing to do to people, but the stuff that I'm not willing to do. And I realize my passion and my love for people is what makes me who I am. And I can't stop being that. And I can't stop giving and doing for people. But what I can do is be more selective with who I give that to. And let me tell you something. All those people that fuck over you, you collect their spirits. So the next time you encounter somebody like them, your antennas will be up because you remember that spirit. You have encountered that spirit. So you become smarter and smarter and smarter, and you start learning the tendencies of dishonest, selfish-ass people. So don't give up. Don't give your heart up. Keep your heart up. A wise man told me one time, he said, David Banner, he said, you're going to have to, he said, keep a bird's heart, but develop a snake's mind. And I'm starting to understand what he's saying. I love you. Stay strong. Do as much as you possibly can, but make sure you do for yourself first. Bless you. Hey, I want to add one other thing to it, man. I called one of my best homeboys in the whole entire world, Edward Muhammad. And he broke down the attributes of Allah. And he was telling me, man, about how every aspect of our personality is needed. You know, whether being the kindest, whether it being the most forgiving. But then, you know, being the biggest warrior or getting off of somebody's ass is also an attribute. Being God, and that being tested is part of it, you know, because with all my meditation, with, you know, all of the things that I've learned, all of the so-called wokeness, that's what the people like to say to me, I'm still from the west side of Jackson. So it's like, good or bad, that's my default. And as much as I think I've gotten control of my anger, and as much as I think that I'm there, I realize in talking to him today, that's why no matter how good of a jump shot you have, Steph Curry still work on his jumper.
every fucking day. Even though he's maybe the best shooter that has ever graced this fucking planet, he still works on that jump shot. And I realize that we gotta still work on, you know, the things that we're good at. You know, even though I don't get angry like I used to, I don't punch holes in walls and all the shit that I used to do, I still have to work, you know, on those things each and every day of my life, and you do too. No matter how good you get at it, no matter how much you think you made it. I remember one dude told me one time, he said, the person that thinks he's a master is the person who's failed. You know, I heard J. Cole say it, like, you never believe in your own hype. You can say that shit all day. I'm the best rapper, I'm the best rapper, I'm the best rapper. But the day that you really think you're the best rapper and you start working on being the best is the day that you failed. So one thing that I want y'all to know is, you know, never ever think that I'm perfect. Never ever think that I know it all. I don't think I know it all. You know, the only thing that I work on with you all is trying to help you all to just consider and to think. And to realize that most of this shit that they gave us is a fucking lie. You know, they want us to continue to be fucking niggas. You know, they want you stressed out. They want you mad. They, you know, because when I get mad, it ain't no halfway. That's why they call me David Banner. It wasn't no rap shit. Once it's on, it ain't no fucking coming back. And I have to work, you know, with all that I have to keep that. Because I want to tell y'all this. This is the most important part of this message. Mr. Whitner taught me something when I went to Charlotte to meet with him. And he's from Pittsburgh. He said, David Banner, keep your eyes on the board. And the board is the prize. So never let anybody get you mad enough. Like, literally now when I look at people and they say shit or they make little fuck comments, I look at their worth on my board. And it's me getting mad at them and doing something worth me taking my eyes off the board. It's not. Nobody is worth that. My family is not worth me taking my eyes off the board. And I'm going to tell you why. As much as family and girlfriends and friends talk that shit about you working, most of them not gonna fuck with you if you can't provide and you can't do for anyway. So you keep your eyes on that fucking prize. You keep your eyes on the fucking board. And everything else will fade away. Everything that makes you mad will fade away if you keep your eyes on the prize and you keep your eyes on the board. And whatever that may end up being, that may be God. That may be success. That may, I don't know what it is for you. And don't let nobody define that for you. But I'm just realizing, man, that it's important for us to start having these conversations with each other, man. And I've learned so much. And I watch so many other people. And it's not my business. They've mastered a certain level of life. But they keep teaching y'all bullshit. And I don't think that's right, man. I could get on this bitch in front. You know, no, man. A lot of that shit that we learned coming up was wrong, man. It got us to where we are. But my mentor, Mr. Moody, taught me that, like, it's cool. Being the old David Banner got you here. But in order for you to get where I am, son, you're going to have to break yourself. You're going to have to change. I hope that helps somebody out there, man. You know, it's something that I heard a Christian say one time that they got out of the Bible, that nothing is supposed to move you but God. You know, it's cool to be in love. It's cool to get angry, but nothing should move you off your square. This is what I want to leave you all with. I'm learning that you have to court everybody. And I don't mean just in relationships. I mean in friendships. I mean in people that you bless. You got to court them. You got to give time to see if they worthy of your blessings. Because you can waste your blessings. You could have held those blessings for somebody that really would have took those blessings and done great things for the world, and you wasted it on some fuck ass. Sorry. I'm back. But love, y'all. And sometimes when people fuck up, they really don't know no better. I had to learn that. Sometimes it's just because they're ignorant. You know, sometimes we be wanting to bust people's ass, but they really don't know no better. They just going off of the program that's been given to them. And sometimes you have to have the information and the understanding that you just have a higher understanding of things, and you have to have the grace of God. You know, we always talk about forgiveness, and we always pray, you know, for forgiveness. But as an individual, God, do you forgive others like you want the Almighty God to forgive you? Think about it.
Man, big facts from David Banner. Welcome to another episode of Real Life, the radio show. Today is May 14th, 2019. And today's show is, what are you going to do with the information? Man, in those last few clips, they just kind of rolled everything out. How you doing tonight, Roz?
Hey, I'm pretty ecstatic to be with you and the other calls and listeners. I greatly appreciate you all. First, I just wanted to say, let me get this out the way. You can support Black Talk Radio Network by either making a donation at blacktalkradionetwork.com, or you can also join our social media space, BTR Community. It is a closed social media space where you can get in touch with like-minded Black people. Quite a few of the show hosts radio show hosts from Black Talk Radio Network are also on the site. And basically, it's a space where we just have candid communication between ourselves about all different issues that pertain to Black people. It is $24 per year, which translates to $2 per month. And ultimately, there's no ads. There's no data mining. There's no selling of your information. And again, like I said, it's a closed space, so it's not like any and everybody could just jump on there and see what's going on. So if you are going for a job interview and they tell you, oh, you need to give us all your social media, you don't have to give them that. They won't find you unless you decide to put your own information out there. And also they would still have to join in order to do so because it's a closed social media space. So I just wanted to put that out there. That way you can help us maintain the platform and continue to provide the programming that we provide. Also, there's a very important museum in Brooklyn, New York, called the Weeksville Heritage Center, and it is the Black Wall Street of Brooklyn, New York, located in Bed-Stuy. I've been there. My wife and I did an event there a few weeks, like a month ago, and it basically is holds some of the most important history about Black people settling in Brooklyn and a safe haven that they created in the heart of Brooklyn for Black people that were trying to get away from racism, white supremacy, and live in an environment where they lived amongst their own people. Very, very powerful place with an incredible history, and they're potentially could close without getting the proper donations. So they do have a GoFundMe that's in all of the different clips and stuff and articles are all located in the Real Life the Radio thread, radio show thread on Black Talk Radio Network. And there's also a link where you can donate to them as well. In order to help keep them open so that we can continue to share this history with Black people and a lot of other people who are quite interested in the history of American Africans in that area of Brooklyn and the wonderful things that they did and the different really interesting and incredible Black people that lived in that particular area. So I just wanted to toss that out there. And then also, you are live, like Jenna said, on Real Life, the radio show with myself, Ross, and my co-host, Jenna Kepler. If you do wish to call, you can do so at 719-284-5271. And the code is 70937. That is 719-284-5271. And the code is 707. That's all I wanted to get out there.
Hey, man, we ought to reach out to them and see if we could get them on the show.
Yeah, actually, I think that's a good idea. I think I should actually do something like that. That would actually be quite good.
Yeah,
I'll try and reach out to them.
That
for sure.
Way, for people who don't know anything about it, you know what I'm saying? They could give them more information. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. I don't know what that was.
Okay.
That was the first. All
right.
But you good. Go ahead.
But yeah, that way you could get a more in-depth description of what it is and who was there and things of that nature. But I know you had a couple more articles you wanted to go over before we get into these clips.
Yes. I would just say that Weeksville was to Brooklyn what Senegal Village was to Manhattan. And Senegal Village was erroneously called Seneca Village, which was also an all-black town area that was pretty much a black Wall Street of Manhattan. And the people there were actually formerly enslaved people, and most of them came from Senegal. So that's where the name Senegal Village came from. And over time, white people corrupted it into Seneca. So people thought it was a quote-unquote Native American area, but it actually wasn't. It was a place that was created by formerly enslaved people, and most of them came from Senegal. So that's what gave it its name. So there's two things I wanted to get into. One, let me just go find it real quick, because they're both pretty much health-related. And it was a sister. Her name was Carrie, and she was on Black Junction. And she reminded me of something. So this one is from Business Insider. Every parent should know the scandalous history of infant formula. So this talked about the fact that, infant formula was introduced by Nestle, and that infant formula is actually toxic to babies, and that they've killed many, many babies, especially African babies, by getting their parents hooked on the use of baby formula, which a lot of us use today. It's continued to grow in use. And this is a very interesting article. I'm not going to read the whole thing, just pretty much two basic sections. So it says here, New York City's campaign against infant formula inspired us to look into the dubious history of this product. Outrage started in the 1970s when Nestle was accused of getting third world mothers hooked on formula, which is less healthy and more expensive than breast milk. What is this? Oh, I gotta get this off my page. Get out of here. What is this? Oh, okay. It's let me see. Let me see. Something. It's like an ad blocker just popped up. I don't know where the heck it came from. Let me just go and open it in the window. Give me a second. Okay. So I don't know if you can pull up the article. There's two,
which
three.
Which one you want to pull up?
Matter of fact, let me see. Because I think I actually, hold on. I can find what I'm looking for. Give me one second. Where is it? Let me go here. Let's see if I can pull it up this way. Yeah, I don't understand why the
Okay, I got here. Let me see. You want to go on the baby killer blew the lid off the formula industry in 1974?
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay. Social rights groups began now am I messing up. Social rights groups began dragging the industry's explosive practices into the spotlight in early 1970s. The New Internationalist published an expose on Nestle's marketing practices in 1973, Babies Means Business, which described how the company got third world mothers hooked on baby formula. And on the little bottle, they have a picture of a real malnourished African. And it has the baby killer.
But it that is because. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
But it was the baby killer. The booklet published by London's War on Warrant organization in 1974 that really blew the lid off the baby formula industry. Is those the only two you wanted?
No, there was a another section a little bit further down. Let me go, because it's very short, but it's very telling because of the psychology of breastfeeding. Hold on. Okay, the article just came up. Here we go. Let's see. Here we go. So it says, this section is further down. It says, playing into the undernourished woman's fears of harming their newborn baby was a confidence trick, quote unquote, said War on Want. When these women felt fear, pain, or sadness, their breast milk would dry up as a result. It is called the letdown reflex, which controls the flow of milk to the mother's nipple, and it is a nervous mechanism, the paper said. Somehow, mothers are deciding that a bottle is necessary to milk that she provides. Some mothers may even become so concerned about not having enough milk that they will not have enough. So they're saying that what they were doing was psychologically tricking the mothers into thinking that they were undernourishing their children with their breast milk, or that the bottle was better than their own breast. And with the psychology of that, their breast milk would dry up, because the production of breast milk is a psychological thing. So if the mother's happy and she's eating the right things, she will naturally profusely create breast milk. But if you trick her into thinking like they did, that something's wrong with her or that she might make her own child sick, then that will psychologically cause her breast to stop putting out milk just about immediately.
Yeah, the stress.
So they would do that in order to force them to say, okay, I got to get this formula. And that was what the issue was. So they were literally malnourishing their children, feeding them this formula. And it's something that's been maintained all the way till today. And then, of course, you know, with the chemicals, the BPA and other chemicals that they line the cans with, that effeminizes male children. And then also you have the soy aspect, which soy is a plant-based estrogen. So it's almost like a double dose of feminine chemicals and hormones that they're getting just from you opening that can and giving them the soy-based product. And it's also undernourishing them because it doesn't have the same nourishment as a mother's breast milk. So this just shows the diabolical psychology that they use to kill millions of babies, because that's exactly what happened. They're in areas that are third world countries, so they're not accessing, you know, the proper nutrients already just because of the environments that they're growing up in. And then on top of that, you have the mothers thinking that the best thing to give them is some white man's company, you know, processed soy milk for their child. So I just wanted to get into that. And then there's one more. Let me just go to that one. Let me see. And I will not be reading the whole thing with that either. Let me see, where is it? Did I open all of them? Let me see, maybe I didn't open them all. Oh, the page is acting up with me now. Damn it. Okay, let's see. Let me just go back. I'm jumping between my phone and this computer because it's acting a fool. Okay, it came back up. Let me see. That went too far.
What you looking for, Ross?
It's the other, like, article.
Hospital viruses.
Yes. Hospital viruses, fake cancerous nodes, and CT scans created by malware trick radiologists. So this is an article that comes from... And this one, thanks to Sister Ajua, she's the one who actually posted it before and I was able to see it. It's from the Washington Post. So what they're discussing pretty much is that they have these viruses that are infecting hospital medical equipment, and it's creating fake cancerous nodes in CT scans, and it's created actually by malware, and it's tricking radiologists into reporting that people have cancer who actually don't. Mm. So now you go in there for the diagnostic test. You have a virus infecting the machine, and the radiologist comes back with, you have cancer now. And you actually don't have it, because the machine, the virus, is what created this diagnosis that doesn't actually exist. And see, this is what I mean when I say with technology, they really just unleash stuff on the public, and there's no checks and balances put in place to be preemptive so that things like this don't happen. So I'm wondering how many people have had surgeries that they did not need. You know what I'm saying? Due to the fact that this is happening, and how many hospitals is this happening at? And like I said, how many people were told to get surgeries that they may not have needed due to the fact that they had a false positive due to this this horrible AI? You know what I mean?
Well, that's what they're gonna blame it on now. I'm not sure, because that's a bug that was created to do that. That's pretty specific. You know, it's going into these specific machines and doing a specific job. It seems pretty calculated. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm just a simple guy, though.
So, yeah, those are the two I wanted to get into as far as the articles were concerned. I just thought they were very important, and people should actually just be aware of this stuff, because who knows, you or maybe somebody you love might be dealing with some of this stuff, might have newborn children that, you know, they might be considering switching to formula off of breast milk. And sometimes there's reasons you can't breastfeed. Like, I know my wife had a C-section, and she had all kinds of drugs in her in order to help her heal. And she couldn't breastfeed because of the drugs being passed on to our son via her breast milk. So there are legit reasons not to be able to breastfeed your child. But they just make that the default now. So the overwhelming majority of women do not breastfeed. And you have, you know, movements in different parts of the world where people are moving towards that. And then you even have a whole business that started in India where they have Indian women bottling breast milk and sending it to England. So the white mothers don't want to breastfeed their own children, but they do want human breast milk. And they're paying people in India to send their bottled breast milk. And I believe also Costa Rica is doing that as well. So they're going to these non-white women, because remember, when a woman gives birth, she has probiotics that the child needs in order to establish the proper gut bacteria. And also that helps develop their immune system. It also provides antibodies to different diseases from the mother to the child. So whatever cumulative antibodies that the mother has developed over her lifetime, she passes that on to her baby to give it a strong start in the immune system being powerful enough to fight illnesses. So this is all of the stuff that you're taking away from your child when you do not breastfeed. You're leaving them to start at zero. And that's the problem, because when they start at zero, then they're susceptible to just about anything. I remember for the first year and a half, almost 2 years that my son was alive, he never got sick. And the doctor's like, how y'all people can get sick? We were like, we don't let him get in contact with other people. Like, nobody's up in his space, and we pretty much keep him away from other people. So he wasn't contacting sick people like that. We were quite meticulous about that with him. So that was a saving grace for him as a child. But so that's the importance of breastfeeding, is that those essential things, and much more than what I just said, but those are two basic but extremely important factors. Those things are being taken from your child, and that can have very deleterious effects on their health if they don't have access to the different nutrients and different substances, elements, and probiotics and things that are in their mother's breast milk. So with that, we're going to move into running through these clips real quick, and then we'll move forward from there. So, man, the Detroit and the paramilitary guards. Okay. So they've created a whole new law enforcement system in Detroit where you can pay for your protection. And this is what I mean when I say black people are the money. If you heard what he said, one of the guys said, he said, we make it so that criminals know that this is not a good area to be a predator. So right there, they're dehumanizing the black people in the area because they're equating them to wildlife. This is not a good place to be a predator, right? And then on top of that, when we commit crime on extremely high levels, we're now creating new systems of being dominated. So now you don't only have to worry about the police, you have to worry about this new paramilitary. Back in the days when I was really, really young in New York City, we had another paramilitary group called the Guardian Angels. And they didn't carry guns. They practiced martial arts for the most part and hand-to-hand combat, but they would ride on every train, usually every other car. They would walk through like a military group with red, you know, outfits and berets and steel-toe boots. And some of them would have, you know, feathers hanging from their hats and things like that. But they would just commandeer the trains and go throughout the trains. And they did cause a reduction in crime. But ultimately, it was just another form of control that was outside of the governmental form of control that we know to be police. So you're opening up yourself to even more contact with people that could potentially kill you just by the fact that you're generating this extra revenue, like you heard the guy in the video saying. you know, we charge them when they leave their jobs $10 to appear for 10 minutes. And every minute after that is $1 a minute so that they can safely get in their cars and drive home. Like, they're making money off of everything. And it's us that's creating that environment by the ways that we respond to the system of white supremacy that are detrimental to our daily existence because they turn it in on us and do things like this. So I just found that to be quite telling. And if it's successful there, then beware, it'll probably come to a city near you soon enough, especially if the crime rate's high enough. The next thing was the wild opium. Wild lettuce opium, but it's not really wild lettuce opium, it's known as wild lettuce. And it grows all over the United States. It was brought here by the Chinese. And it's like it's pretty much a weed. But I've talked about it before. They have discussed the fact that it is more powerful than actual morphine, but it doesn't get you high. And it's something that you won't fail a drug test for. And I know that, you know, I've gotten it from Amazon. They have it in tea forms. They have it in tincture forms where you can put drops in a hot glass of water and make tea. But it's wonderful at killing pain, and it can also help you get rest as well if you're sleepy or if you have trouble sleeping. It'll get rid of your pain and help you be able to drift off into sleep. It's also good for relaxation and a few other things as well. But wild lettuce is an incredible natural painkiller that people should have, especially if you're going into a doomsday scenario and things are getting psychotic as far as the U.S., China, and Russia right now. So a lot of this talk of the collapse is going to be happening quite soon and quite quickly. So I would say this is an essential thing to have in your pantry in case things do hit the fan. And if you have a chronic pain you deal with or a relative that deals with chronic pain, this is something you can use to naturally help yourself. If you have weeping willows in your area, you can use the bark of the willow tree. That's where aspirin comes from. I happen to live in an area where there are quite a few weeping willows, so that's always a good prospect. But that's just another thing I wanted to throw out there for people in case, you know, like I said, a shit hits the fan scenario comes around and you might need to deal with that. Those are some of the things you can do. So I just wanted to just kind of touch on that. And then the funny part is he's talked about Gaia Sophia. Of course, Gaia is one of the old names for Earth. And then Sophia is actually the Kemetic goddess of wisdom, very closely associated with Maat and Aset. So very, very interesting choice of words that he thought to use. And also that's where you get the term philosophy from, is from Sophia, philosophia, or wisdom. Pretty much the study of becoming more intelligent and wise, pretty much.
Well, hold on just a second. You're moving about a little fast tonight.
Oh, my bad. Go ahead.
Let me get to these paramilitary guards also, because I...
Okay, my bad.
First thing I noticed is that it was a black man that was the spokesperson for this operation. Mm-hmm. That was the first thing I noticed. And like he said, in BTR community under Real Life Radio, y'all can go check out that video also. But almost everybody else was white who was in his group. So that was something that stood out to me. Another thing is that they were just riding around the neighborhoods with their lights flashing and big Humvees. And like he said, creating a presence of fear to kind of push off any intrusion, I would guess. It sounds like a takeover. That's what it seemed to me. And my last question, if you would like to go back to this or any of the listeners that's listening, my last question to the paramilitary group is, what would happen when these brothers or some of these Italian gang members get tired of this and they decide to ambush him or to just fight heads up? Like, it's a lot of things that could go wrong with that. And not to mention, like you said, just the intimidation and the extra security that's going around. It seems like they're trying to get people out of the city. They going to do that. People get fed up and then they move on. And then, because see, they never mentioned who were, I mean, I know you can't just say who the clients were, but why can't you? I don't know.
Yeah. And you know, because Detroit is a very important city, a support city.
Correct.
So if they could get black people up out of there, then they can create a whole new paradigm and make it a lot easier for goods and services literally to get to white folks.
Well, they already doing that, and that's China buying up a lot of that Detroit property right now for the last few years, actually. But
no, you absolutely right. Oh, go ahead. What are you going to say?
I'm just going to move on so I can catch up with you on this this wild lettuce.
Oh, go ahead, my bad.
This was something that you introduced me to. And one of the things I want, you pretty much covered it, but I had just one question. And just for those who are listening, I'm going to give you a short list of what it's good for. Whooping cough, asthma, urinary tract problems, coughing, trouble sleeping, excuse me, restlessness, menstrual cycle. It helps all type of symptoms. The one thing I was curious about, though, was he said that he was going to make tar out of it.
Yes.
Can you, I'm not sure if I'm the only one that was wondering, but what is he talking about?
What he's talking about is pretty much making a liquid concentrate. So it's almost like when he talks about boiling it down, you kind of boil it down till it becomes almost like a syrup.
See, that's like heroin, and that's exactly what I thought when he called it tar.
Yeah.
So
I don't think he's smoking it, though, because the only ways I know of taking it, I'm sure people do smoke it, but the only ways I know of taking it is in a tea form. So, and then he talked about using it in the same way as well. So you would pretty much put it in water, hot water, mix it in, and then if you're going to sweeten it at all, you sweeten it to taste. I know it's a bitter. It's one of those bitter herbs, and bitter herbs taste disgusting, but they're actually the healthiest for you. So, you know, some people might say, okay, well, this is not my favorite flavor here. Let me add some honey to it or some maple syrup or some blackstrap molasses or something like that. But that's what he meant when he was talking about the tar. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And you're right. It did sound like heroin. I thought the same.
Because when after he said that, he said it's good for life's pain. And I only done heard that from a heroin addict.
Yes, sir. But he said that he was taking Percocet for the headache before that. So, you know, he was messing with the stuff. I don't know if he was addicted to it before. He didn't say so. But you're right. Like, his lingo is as such that you would think that he might have had an issue with it in the past.
I mean,
you know, and matter of fact, go ahead.
I only asked that question because, like you say, he was taking Percocets, and then he just completely winged off the Percocets for the wild lettuce. So
yeah, and it doesn't get you high. So it's not like he's getting high off the lettuce at all. It does not get you high at all. Like I say, it will help you relax if you need to. If you have trouble sleeping, it'll help you sleep. And if your lack of sleep is due to pain, it'll help you get rid of the pain and also help you go to sleep. So, you know, so yeah. So he could be, but I know he ain't getting high off of that. There's no high to get off of it.
Okay, I just wanted to ask.
But it's
that
highly
question.
Effective. Oh, no problem. That's why I was laughing when he said opium, because it's not actually called wild lettuce opium. It's just called wild lettuce. But they always compare it to opium because that's the only other drug that is as similar to it. And I think it's just a couple of chemical elements on the chemical chart different from opium. But in that slight difference, it is completely non-addictive. And like I said, it's not like you'll ever fail a drug test for having wild lettuce opium, because it's not even a plant on the radar of drug companies. It's one of those remedies that they don't want you to know about because it's natural, and they can't patent something that's natural. They can only patent something that's changed from its natural state to a chemical form. In other words, they create something new, and then they patent that new thing. You know, so yeah, very, very good stuff. So, oh yeah, the next one. You are live on Real Life the Radio Show with myself, Brother Rod, and my co-host, Linda Kepra. If you do wish to chime in, give us a call at 719-284-5271. Again, that's 719-284-5271. And the code is 70637.
that you gave us. Man, before we continue on, I just want to give a shout out to my partner D coming out of Atlanta, man.
Yes.
A lot of stuff that we be discussing and telling and trying to at least give you some type of information that so that you could go and at least check it out for somebody that you know, whether it's a coworker, family member, any kind of loved one. And he listened to me. He listened to me while he was still getting help like any sane person would do. And it just so happens what I had told him to do as far as silver and some diet changes was helping. And that's exactly what his doctors told him to do. So that was I was happy for him. I don't even have the words to describe it. But I just wanted to give that little shout out to D and his wife real quick.
Yeah.
Go ahead and continue, Ross. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, I met a sister at the event we did in Brooklyn last week, and she actually had lupus. I didn't find out until later on in our conversation, but I actually ended up, she ended up buying a bottle of silver from me. Actually, I sell Corona Silver too, so if anyone's interested in getting it, you can reach out to me at my email, raskelile@comcast.net, but we were talking. And she came out, and I was telling her about Sister T and the fact that, you know, she was dealing with the same condition. And we had, you know, recommended and provided her with the silver and the colloidal silver and the CBD. And it was able to stabilize and then pretty much remove the condition. Like, she didn't really show signs of having it. And the sister was so blown away with that. So I gave her more information about it, and I told her where she could read up about silver's efficacy on lupus, and it's documented, the documented evidence of its ability to actually help people with lupus in an incredibly powerful way. And she was just kind of shocked because she had actually said she was planning to buy silver. She had it sitting in her cart on Amazon and she forgot about it. And she went back months later and was like, what did I have this silver here for? What was this for? And she forgot. So when she talked to me, it just kind of resurrected things because she had just heard about it from a friend, but she totally forgot what she was getting it for, everything. And when I mentioned, you know, the sister that we were dealing with in regards to her dealing with lupus and how much help she got from it, she was like ecstatic. So I'm waiting to hear back from her when she's able to really start utilizing the CBD and the colloidal silver together. And I'm so interested to hear about her results, because I'm pretty sure they're going to be quite powerful once I hear back from her. So, yeah. And also, I've been dealing with severe lower back pain for about a month now. I'm about to get ready to see a chiropractor, but the main thing that has helped me with that, too, is CBD. It's really made it so that I'm not – and I've never had back problems, but this is very new for me. So it's very uncomfortable. So I will say, again, personal testimony. So, you know, it does work. I will say that. It does work. And it works for a myriad of things, but it does work. Go ahead, what you were going to say?
No, I was just agreeing, because between me and my family, my children, yeah, every time they get out of school because the school's sick, they end up having a vacation.
Right. Yep, because they're healthy and the rest of the school is sick. You're right. It works. It really, really works. So just wanted to toss that out there for anyone who might be within earshot. So to pick up where we left off,
Law 15.
Check your text. Yeah, check your text, Jenna, too. Law 15. Law 15, crush your enemies totally. Now, this is a law that I've gone by since I was probably in my teens, because I read the 48 Laws of Power, the Book of the Five Rings, the Art of War. I started reading those texts around 14, 15, and I've always had them in my library. Those are books that I refer to all the time. So I started applying those things even when I was running the streets. And it's something that I've seen play themselves out in many different ways. And I like the scenarios that he gave as far as Jordan, you know, down to the last second, he's just, you know, he's going hard to the end, no matter what's on the clock. And I've seen so many of his games. He was like my favorite ball player as a child. So I know what he's talking about. And you can apply it in many, many different ways in your life, whether it's in business, whether it's in a personal relationship or a personal conflict. It could be in a debate, and I've done that before too, where somebody will, you know, just have a good old time. And once you do your research and you know what you're talking about, you can come with really, really powerful, accurate, or scientific sources to back up what you're dealing with, and you come in and the person is quote-unquote debating you, you can really shut them down if you know how to go about setting that up. That's one of the things that made Malcolm a genius. And that's one thing that I applied to my study, and I don't really debate anymore. I don't have time for that. And but when I did, you know, is that Malcolm would always study both sides, not just his position on something, but the other person's position, so that he would be so learned on the subject that he would actually be able to run rings around his competition and even use aspects of their own position against them. And these are things that it takes a certain level of insight and just wisdom to really know how to do things like that. And it's not something that comes easy to some people. That's why I always suggest, you know, for people, if you can, get into playing chess. Chess teaches you how to think strategically, how to make the proper decisions. That's what life is really about, decision making. And based on decisions you make, it can affect your life 5 minutes from now, 5 hours from now, 5 days from now, 5 years from now, or even affect the world 500 years from now, depending on what you do. So it's just really about understanding that when you have an adversary, and it doesn't necessarily always mean violence or physicality, it just means crushing them, making it so that they are completely, how would I call it? They're impotent. You make it so that they're completely incapable of doing anything else when you're done with them. And that's something I apply when I ran the streets. That's something that I apply psychologically, depending on who and what I'm dealing with in this context of the situation. And that is something that we as a people don't fully understand. That's why I like, and it kind of, this kind of goes into some of the other clips in regards to the next one. Bumpy Johnson had people working in Dutch Schultz's house, and other Jewish gangsters' houses. So he always knew what they were doing before they did it. And he was so genius that he had an entire system set up where he could bring sisters up from down south or people up from down south who wanted to work, because he was originally from South Carolina. He would set them up in one of his three hotels, make sure that they were good, buy them clothes, whatever, give them some money for their pocket. And then, you know, if they were going to be domestic, he would set them up in the houses of Jewish gangsters so that they could overhear everything that they were talking about and then report to him. You know, he was that intelligent and that forward thinking. And that's generalship. That's outthinking your enemy. That's literally placing an enemy right amongst your enemy, and they have no idea that they have somebody there that's literally just bringing the news. And a lot of us can't even think on that level today. when the elder was saying, you know, it's just not possible. People don't think that way. We think to go on Facebook and tell everybody our business, or commit crimes and film it and then post it on Facebook or post it on some other social media. So people aren't, it's like the intelligence level has reverted. But I mean, just those are little lessons we could take in trying to fight the system of white supremacy. But we can't even come together on coalescing around solving problems. So how could we even create a system of being able to thwart what's being done to us when we're not even organized at the most basic level? If we were, then we could have different people in hospitals and amongst high-level politicians and things like that who are reporting to us. So there it is. You crush your enemy totally by knowing everything they're doing. The next one, Dutch Schultz was killed by the three white escapees from Alcatraz. That I remember, I saw a whole documentary on it on the Bio Channel, and it was three white escapees who he basically helped escape, and they thought that they died. Actually, in the documentary, it said that they were probably eaten by great white sharks because there were great white sharks around that area. And it's funny, these people, they were able to off Dutch Schultz for Bumpy. And if anybody knows the history of the New York area, right between Long Island, from Long Island all the way out to central southern Jersey, is all a great white shark breeding ground. And actually, they found in the last 3 to 5 years that great whites are coming back to the area now because their food is back, which is the fur seal. They found them under the Brooklyn Bridge and all of that. So great whites are in the area. They don't attack people because their food source is there. That's why they have not had a great white shark attack on any of the Long Island beaches or Coney Island Beach or none of that. But in the documentary I saw about 2 years ago, they followed a female great white that was swimming right near where people were, about 200 feet out from the shore. Mm. So, yeah. And these people were able to off Dutch Schultz because he made a deal with them in prison to help them get out. He was that powerful. And they said, we owe you. We'll do whatever you want. So there it is. He even was able to have people in the enemy's camp who looked like them.
Yeah.
And have them at under his control to do whatever he wanted. Now, the brilliance of Bumpy Johnson just can't be overstated. Real talk. Like, it's just some serious stuff. And when you're talking about generalship and controlling things and having your hands on the pulse of the city and being able... And the thing was, Bumpy wasn't a drug dealer. He was strictly into numbers. That was his thing. He didn't want nothing to do with hustling, anything like that, to his people. And he was a man of the people. Where, like they said, if you were in Harlem, you couldn't starve unless you wanted to starve. So he was a different type of quote-unquote gangster who actually did things to help his people. Pee Wee Kirkland was another one. I mean, granted, he was selling heroin. But the bottom line is he did so much to help so many people that he's a legend to this day, not just on the basketball court, but for the things that he did for his people, even though he was peddling poison. That's the difference. Bumpy didn't peddle poison. You know what I'm saying? So it's just real. And those are examples of you know, just generalship and forethought. The next one, Bill Duke, seeing his dad punch the two cops in his face and take their guns. Now, that's black self-respect. Where would you hear something like that today in 2019? You're not going to hear that. But I mean, think about that. His family was disrespected. And again, it goes back to the name. You know, Tariq Nasheed and other folks, they like to call us coons and monkeys, some of our people coons and monkeys. Why are you taking the same names that your enemy called you to degrade you, and then you're calling another black man that? And like Dave Banner said, it's because somewhere in your psyche, you want to be like the white man. Mm. So you take the same mentality and apply it on your own people. Now, am I saying that there aren't traitors and people who do things to help white people subjugate other black people? Absolutely. But the name calling isn't doing anything. What is that doing? You might make some people laugh for a few minutes, but what are you actually doing to change the situation by calling them a coon? What is that? Afrikoon and Caracoon and all the nonsense that, you know, anti-black made-up names that we take from white people and we commandeer it and then say, oh, well, I'm just going to use this for other black people. That sounds like it's ridiculous. Like David Banner said, how are you going to take the most heinous word created in history for black people and call yourself that or call other black people that? You're not going to get my respect doing that. It's just not going to work for me. You could do that with other folks. You're not going to do that with me. So, you know, it's real talk. And I think that, you know, when you see something like, okay, this guy, this cop disrespected my family. He punched him in the face. He took his gun. He punched the other cop in the face, took his gun, and then went straight to the precinct. That is some serious testicular fortitude. And it's all about black self-respect. And then what did the white chief, police chief do? I respect you. I wouldn't want anybody disrespecting my family either. So, you know, it doesn't mean that every situation may work out in your favor. But the bottom line is, if you set a precedent of I'm not tolerating things, then eventually the people who are oppressing are going to have to think twice about oppressing you. But we're just not organized. We went through a lot, but when the Black Panthers were around, white people were on notice that they couldn't do whatever the heck they wanted anymore. And we have no collective organization amongst ourselves to do that like we did in the past. So the difference is there's a disconnect because there's so many factions with so many ideologies, and each of these ideologies are pit against each other. So if you're not following the ideology of someone else, whether it's religious or political or whatever else, then you basically turn your back on those particular people. So you're never able to coalesce with them around solving problems because one might be a Christian and one might be a Hebrew. One might practice African traditional religion. One might be a Rasta. And everybody's just not talking to each other. So we have to get past that kind of stupidity in order for us to collectively coalesce around solving problems. If we can't do that, then we're going to continue to face what we've been facing for the last 500 years. And that's everywhere on the planet. So, you know, it's just really deep how that whole thing comes together. And then there's another one. When Malcolm X was talking about, I think he was on the flight, and the white woman was looking at his briefcase. I mean, white people are always watching you. They're always analyzing you down to every little thing. She's watching the initials on his briefcase, and then got the nuts up to say, well, what name would you have? Because she's like, I know Negro name, and there's no Negro name that starts with an X. So she's already 10 steps ahead on that. Like, oh, you wouldn't have that. Let me ask you, you know, what name would that be? And when she finally found out who he was, like he said, she was thinking she was going to see horns and all this crazy stuff, because she was conditioned to think that Malcolm X was this demonic character that hated white folks and was ready to kill every white person he saw. So again, it speaks to the power of propaganda and how the powers that be can make the, like Scotty took from Malcolm X too, make the guilty look innocent and the innocent look guilty. She never saw him, but she knew that in her mind, once she found out who he was, that he was this larger than life evil character that she was told about. And when she met him, he was just an intelligent guy having a nice conversation. You know what I'm saying? So it just is, I think it's really, really, really powerful. What do you want to chime in on? I hope I didn't move too far ahead.
It's all good. And for anybody that's listening, if you want to chime in, remember that you give us a call. That number is 719-284-5271. And the PIN is 70637. What is it? What you press? Star 61 to open the mic up, Ross?
Yeah, I believe it's star 61, yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, let me back up a little bit. Law 15 was pretty much very self-explanatory. I think one of the biggest takeaways from Law 15 and all of the laws in the 48 Laws of Power is to know which side you're on. Because I think a lot of us look at it from an individual standpoint in the individual circumstances we're facing at that particular moment that we think about Law 15. When we should be thinking about Law 15 as a state of people, even though we are fractured, but as a group of people, we are under the foot in Law 15. We are the ones being crushed. And I think that's something that we need to circulate that and propagandize that a lot more, just so people could, even the ones who are awake, can remember that's the end goal, is to get from up under that boot. As far as Bumper Johnson, it was important for you to mention that that's all he did was run numbers. Because unless you do some research, yeah, most people don't know that. People just assume that he was a drug dealer. And
absolutely,
one of the things that we don't have, and they mentioned unity during that speech.
Yes, they did.
But Bumpy started out up under somebody whooping people, but that's how he got, you know, that's how he got his come up, right?
Right.
People who are doing that now, they're just jumping out there and they murdering whoever get in their way. There's no rules whatsoever. You know, that old saying, honor amongst thieves, is none of that within the so-called gang culture. Now, one of my questions, and this could be to the listeners and to you as well, Roz, or it may just be rhetorical, but we need those young brothers and sisters who are out there doing that. How do we approach them to show them the different means of creating income? Because essentially, that's the reason why they're out there.
Right.
And if we find that particular answer, as far as, say, setting up storefronts and giving them somewhere to work, or exploiting their ideas as far as if they want to be a clothing designer, producing these, producing textiles for them to be able to practice and work on that instead of going into debt, into college, these type of things. I'm gonna just try to catch up with you real quick. I'm gonna leave that there with Bumper Johnson. Bill Duke, okay. One of my first, the first thing I noticed is how racist Vlad is. The first thing he did is that he wanted to make sure to have him being the black man, Bill Duke, to say that we inflict pain on each other. And it seemed like he enjoyed trying to get that out of his mouth. He couldn't say it fast enough. And that could be nothing, but it was something that I took a hold to. But all at the same time, to hear Bill Duke say that and how he explained the story, it seems as if he feels that's where the self-hate started, because we couldn't do nothing about the mistreatment we was getting at work, like a lot of people still receive right now today. So we take it out on ourselves. That was the biggest takeaway I got from Bill Duke, along with, just to follow what you were saying, how the slave catcher used the word coon.
Right.
I think that was very profound, how he used the word coon, because he wasn't black talking about another black man.
Right.
So, you know. But David Banner, he picked right up where Bill Duke left off, you know. So I know it's about time for us to get on out of here, and I know we still got to get to the spiritual conversation, though. Unless there's any callers out there that want to voice their opinion before we go ahead. If not, Brother Ross, go ahead.
All right. One of the things that I've talked about before, because the next time we're going to get into the ancestral stuff, but this is pertaining to different abilities that we have as African people that we've lost due to colonization. And I've talked about that before. There's a lot of things that people would think are miraculous or just unbelievable. Like, you read certain things in the Bible and it just sounds unbelievable. If you're, you know, a person who is of one of the three major Western religions, which is founded on biblical teaching, you'll be familiar with those stories. And the thing is that a lot of this stuff, some of it's actually real. And the thing is that the means of accessing those abilities we've been severed from, because if you're in practicing Western religion, you are in a system that was stolen from your ancestors, commandeered by your enemy, recreated under a ritualistic, dogmatic practice, and then, you know, given back to you in an altered form with the former slave master as the deity. Now, does that mean that all black people worship a white god? No, because there's quite a few black Christians and they have black Jesuses in their house. But that is a fairly recent phenomenon. For the most part, we have worshiped the white Jesus for the most part, unless you might be a practitioner of what they would call the syncretic religions, like but they didn't really have them in America proper like they did in the Caribbean and in South America. And that would be like Santeria, Candomblé, and Lukumi. These are all traditions that, and the Vodun, that were pretty much a syncretization between Christianity and the Ifa tradition of the Yoruba people. So they basically, the saints in Christianity were coupled with the African counterparts that had the same powers and abilities, and our ancestors would call the names of different saints, but in secret worship their African gods that did the same or had the same powers as the saints that they were worshiping in front of their white masters. And this is, I'm going to read something because I think it, you know, it's good to just have a firsthand account, and that way it makes it much more clear. There's a great book that I suggest people read if they want to understand some of these abilities and how this stuff works. It's called The Santeria Experience, and the author is Mihene, and it's Migene Gonzalez Whippler, and Whippler is Wipplerer. And she was a Puerto Rican woman who was raised by an African Puerto Rican nanny. And she was from an area called Arecibo in Puerto Rico, which is a very, very black area in Puerto Rico to this day. And there's a few others as well. And she was raised practicing the Ifa tradition from birth because they still, you know, practice the initiatic process and all of that stuff. And she was also a Christian as well, but she practiced that syncretic version of Santeria. So she had the Ifa deities coupled with the Christian saint. Now, when she was taking care of this girl, she started taking care of her around 5 years old until she ended. She was pretty much part of the family until she went to college. And all that time, her mother was absolutely against anything to do with the African religion at all. But she wanted her daughter to be a Christian. That was it. And the woman actually ended up teaching her from the age of five, putting her through different, giving her different bits of information from the tradition, and she gained certain spiritual power from and abilities from what this woman taught her and the connection she made with these African gods. Now, when I say gods, it's not in the context of what we know God to be. What they really are principles in nature that also reside in the human being. And you're able to have as intimate a relationship with that principle in nature, what they call Neturu in Kemet, or they call Orisha in the Ifa tradition, Abasam in the Akan tradition. You can have as intimate a relationship with that entity as you do with another human being. And what you're going to read about is this woman, Mahani Whipley. This is pretty much her autobiography. She came to a point where she went to college. They started teaching her about religion. And basically teaching her about philosophy versus religion. And she started to become more aligned with philosophy over religion. And eventually she discarded religion while she was in college. And she ended up in a situation that turned out to be a life or death situation. And in that situation, she went back to what she knew, which was what Maria, her nanny, if I remember her name correctly, taught her. And in this scenario, you get to see that power and that intimate relationship with a deity by the name of Shango. So I'm just going to read this so you can pick up on it, but I just wanted to give you that preface so you understood the context before I did. So let me see here. Let me start here and then I'll stop. Yeah, I'll stop here. Okay. So let me see. Here it goes. Even so, Professor Machado's erudition exacted a heavy toll upon my faith. Prodded by his vigorous dialectic, I slowly shed some of my most basic religious beliefs. With Kant and Spinoza, I came to accept that the existence of God cannot be proven by reason and can only be accepted through faith. By the end of my first year in college, I concluded that logic supersedes all other values. Religion and superstition, as I now called Maria's teachings, were not based upon logical foundations and therefore had to be discarded. So that's what you're hearing is colonization in college. The decision to give up all my religious upbringing was not an easy one, and I felt as if I were uprooting my soul altogether with my beliefs. I spent the better part of that first year crying bitterly over my self-imposed renunciation, but I also felt that my decision was necessary. Eventually, I outgrew the pain and broke away from religion. Had Maria still been with me, at this point she had passed away, perhaps I might have had difficulty in abandoning her teaching, but her death had been a turning point in my life. I felt that a part of me had died with her, and the rebirth in my personality demanded a completely new direction. My mother's Catholic beliefs were not strong enough to withstand the onslaught of incipient existentialism. I was left alone to face the world with nothing stronger than my youth and my idealism. The next 2 years I had passed with hardly any changes. Then something happened that forced me to reassess my values all over again. During my junior year, one of my friends invited me to a party located a few miles from the university. Her brother agreed to pick me up at the student hall where I was lodging and bring me back when the party was over. Unfortunately, the day of the party was damp and stormy. Hurricane alerts were posted throughout the island. Undaunted, I went ahead with my preparations for the party, but by the time my escort arrived, it was raining heavily and visibility was poor. We drove for nearly an hour through near total darkness and torrential rain. Several times we took a wrong turn and had to stop the car and get back on the road. During one of those wrong turns, the car skidded on the wet asphalt and plunged down a ravine. The final impact left me momentarily dazed but unhurt. When I recovered myself, I saw my friend's brother was unconscious and possibly badly injured. I had no idea where we were. The darkness was absolute. But I knew we needed help as soon as possible. Groping for the door handle, I finally managed to get out of the car. The instant I stepped into the night, I was drenched in an icy rain. The wind was so strong I could barely manage to stand, and I had to remove my shoes to avoid slipping in the mud. I ventured a few steps forward, but the wind made me lose my balance, pitching me headfirst onto the ground. The rain was so heavy I could hardly keep my eyes open. I had made several attempts to get up, but the slippery mud prevented me from getting back on my feet. Shivering in the cold, I huddled on the ground, too tired to persevere. I could see no way out as long as the rain and the darkness continued. In my growing despair, my thoughts went back to the safety of my childhood. During heavy storms, Maria would hover around me, always with the same request. Go ahead, Florecita. Ask Shango to stop the rain. He'll do it for you. I would laugh and call out at the top of my lungs for Shango to stop the rain. For me, it was a game. But when the rain stopped shortly after my request, I was never surprised. But now, as I sat in the midst of the slashing rain and the darkness, I realized it was no longer a game. Would it still work? Could I still conjure the simple, innocent childhood faith that I had abandoned in my search for reality? How could I make something happen if I didn't believe in it? Unless that something was a part of an independent reality that existed, whether or not I believed in it. I had nothing to lose by trying. If I failed, I would simply be back to where I started. If I succeeded, I would save myself and my companion, and also find proof of a reality entirely independent of my own. With great effort, I stood up, using both arms to protect my face from the violence of the rain. Struggling to keep my balance, I looked up to the sky, half drowned in the unending waters. Shango, I cried out with all of my remaining strength. Can you hear me? Once you told me to call if I ever needed you. I need you now. Stop the rain. Show me the way to safety. Shango, can you hear me? Shango. In the distance, I heard the soft peal of thunder. I listened anxiously, and the thunder reverberated once more. This time closer, my heart started to beat faster in my chest. And suddenly I caught myself wishing that my call would go unanswered. I simply did not know if I could face an answer. The thunder continued to grow closer. Suddenly, a blinding flash crossed the sky, and I watched aghast as a lightning bolt slashed through the darkness and fell directly in front of me. Small pools of water sizzled at the contact, and the wet grass was burned to the ground. Almost simultaneously, the rain and the wind diminished in intensity, until only a few drops were falling softly over me. The deafening roar that followed the lightning gave way in me to a strange composure. All of my fears and misgivings seemed to disappear, and I felt great serenity. When a second bolt of lightning fell a little further away, I was neither shocked nor frightened. I simply followed its direction. In this fashion, I walked out of the dark ravine, following the fiery path of lightning bolt upon lightning bolt, guiding my steps. Several hours later, my companion and I were both receiving proper medical attention. For him, the adventure was over. For me, it was only beginning. I will stop there. So she was able to create a personal relationship with an African god from Nigeria that was bought by slaves, enslaved people, I should say, to Puerto Rico. She was given a mini initiation from the age of 5, where she had such an intimate relationship with Shango, she played a game where she would stop the rain basically at will. And she had given up all of these beliefs because college instilled in her philosophy and logic over religion and spirituality. And she was able to reach back in herself to that childhood self and that relationship she had with this great deity, this ancient deity. And through that relationship, her life was saved, and her friend's brother who was driving her to the party's life was saved. And that is one of many stories I've heard. Like, I've heard some incredible stories from different people I know that are initiates or priests or priestesses of that tradition, where things that the average person would think are miraculous are everyday things, because there's a reality outside of the one that you've been given by the matrix, whether it's the computer, the TV, the video game. All of those are artificial realities. But in nature, there are deities that reside in nature, and they will be able to take care of you in ways when you need their assistance if you have that intimate relationship with them. And she was able to see, if you listen to the story, there was an intelligence to the lightning. It kept striking a few feet ahead of her, so it lit up her path so she could see where she was going. The rain stopped, and the lightning literally guided her out from that ravine to a safe place where she could get assistance. I've heard stories down south in the southern United States, and there's an actual Yoruba village called Oyetunji Village in, I believe, South Carolina. It's an actual village with a Yoruba chief that was enthroned in Nigeria, and they have this land here in South Carolina, if I remember correctly. And I've heard stories of people down south, and this is something that I've heard about in Trinidad too, because I have people in my family that practice the tradition as well, where if there's a severe thunderstorm, or sometimes even hurricanes and tornadoes, that they'll take out one of Shango's implements, which is a double-headed axe, and they're able to cut the storm. There's a ritual you go through where you can literally slice the storm up, and that storm will not come to you at all. It'll just break up before it reaches your house. And there's many, many stories like that, where there's this intimate connection with this unseen entity, and this entity takes care of his children. Those children tend to be initiates or people who are what they call alejos, which are people who are not initiated, but they are a member of the tradition as far as their belief in the deity and them being a part of that system of that African tradition, though they may not be initiated. So that's just one example. And there's many other examples like that. But in a tradition that doesn't really have the initiatic process to give you that intimacy as far as that relationship, you're not going to be able to get those responses in that form or fashion. You might get other responses, even ancestral responses.
Well, let me.
But that is something. Go ahead.
Let me be the opposing argument here.
Uh-huh.
Probably the most common question will be, well, if this can happen, why haven't anybody got together and done this to get rid of white supremacy? How would that be tackled?
Well, because the relationship with the deity is personal. So everybody, that's one thing about specifically African traditions and basically indigenous traditions globally. None of them proselytize. And proselytize means to go around and spread your religion or force other people to practice your religion. It's only the Western religions that have done that to other people. So that is why it doesn't work in that collective fashion, because you don't have legions and legions of people who are initiated. The majority of the planet is 2/3 Christian. The vast majority of the remaining people are Islamic. And then the remainder out of that will practice like Buddhism and Jainism, Hinduism, and these other traditions. So, again, the relationship with the deity is personal. So you have instances where people have personal relationships with the deity, and they've been able to mitigate white supremacy due to that relationship. Like, I remember there were initiates that I knew that worked in the World Trade Center before it collapsed. And there were a few of them that told me that because they have like altars that they set up, and they have certain implements, spiritual implements that relate to the deities whose systems they have been initiated into. And usually you have daily contact with them first thing in the morning, sometimes throughout the day, and then of course last thing at night. And they have said that when they would go to their altar to communicate with their deity, they were told not to go to work that day. They didn't know why they were told not to go to work, but they were admonished not to go to work. And that day was the day that the buildings collapsed. Like there's a deity that's known as Oshun, and this is not the Oshun that people are familiar with, which is the female deity that is the Yoruba goddess of the river. It's not her. This one is actually, its symbol is a silver cup with a rooster on the lip of the cup, and they have bells around the lip of the cup. And if a person is in mortal danger, where their life is at stake, that cup will fall over. So anytime a Yoruba initiate goes to work with their deity and that Oshun cup is laid over, they know that there's a situation that could potentially be fatal for them that's awaiting them that day. And that's one of the signs you can get, or sometimes you'll just have visitations by the deity. It all depends. But this is what I heard from personal accounts of people that I knew that survived 9/11 that were Yoruba initiates. So that is a way in which it can mitigate white supremacy, but it's very personal because of the relationship that person established with the deity. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
So it works differently due to that kind of a position and mindset versus a collective mindset. So, Greg, what are you going to say?
I was just, I understand what you're saying, but I know that'll be one of the questions.
Oh, yeah. And it's crazy because I've even had my own experiences. I'll give one experience, and this one has to do with the ancestors. And it always, when I think about it, it kind of gives me the chills and it trips me out. And there was a time many years ago, my son was young, and I wasn't working at the time. I was unemployed. I was laid off. And it was just, financially, it was really bad. It was me, my wife, my son. We were in the house, and we had to pay taxes on our house, quarterly taxes. And the taxes are quite expensive. And at the time, I was getting unemployment, but the unemployment was nowhere near enough to really cover what I needed. So at the time, I went to my dad, and I asked him because he had a lot of money saved. So I was like, I'll borrow from my father, and then I'll pay him back. So I went to him, and I asked him to borrow the money. It's like $1,000 that I needed. I had the rest. I just needed a grand to make up the difference. And then I told him, you know, I'll pay it back. I can't give it to you in a lump sum, but I can give it to you in increments. And I discussed that with him and everything. And then he turned around and told me no. And it wasn't because he didn't have it. He was just in his bag in that moment. And that's something that I've had to deal with my father in the past. We've had issues, and it was many years that we weren't speaking surrounding certain family events and things that happened between him and I. But in this instance, this is one of the quote-unquote good times when we were in communication with each other for a while and things like that. So I was thinking, okay, well, you know, I've never asked my dad for anything. This is the first time I'm asking him, and it's important. I'm not asking him to go buy some frivolous shit. I'm asking him because this is my taxes, and if I don't pay him, I'm not going to have a house to live. So he told me no, and I'll never forget. It was so, because he was like the last resort. We had tried everything else. We had, you know, dealt with everybody else that we knew that we might be able to borrow money from to get this taken care of. And it just wasn't happening. And I was just completely deflated. I was quite angry because of the way that he had talked to me. And I was just in a whole nother space of rage. I was like blind with rage and hurt. So I have a ancestral altar in my house, and I've had it for many years. And it's a place that my family congregates around, and sometimes when we're going through the most difficult times, we'll go there and just have candid conversation with our ancestors. So I went there, and I was mad as hell. So I'm cursing, and I'm like, yo, this is fucked up, and I'm just going off, and I'm really angry. And I started crying. I just broke down. I said, what the heck am I going to do? This money's due very soon, and this is just not going to work. So my wife came. She prayed with me there. My son prayed with me there. And she was more upset because of the level of upset that I was in. And I was just like, I need to catch myself because I don't want this despair to spread to the point where it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So we prayed together. And then I walked away from the altar, and I went in my room, and I was just trying to meditate and calm myself down because I just went off. I just like laid everything out at the altar. It was like, you know, such a release, but I went and I was exhausted. So I sat there, and within a couple of hours, the phone rang. Who's on the phone? My quote unquote white friend. He turned out to be my last white friend. And he's a filmmaker. So he had called me, and he was like, yo, Raj, there's a job to work on a commercial set in Connecticut. And the job will pay you $500 a day cash for 2 days. This was on a Friday that this happened with my father. He told me that he called me that night after everything happened with my father and told me that Saturday and Sunday, if I wanted to, I could work this job in Connecticut and I can make $500 a day cash, which is exactly what I needed to make up the difference of my rent. So I'm sitting there like, yo, I can't script this. So I said, absolutely. So I ended up going, and I did the job. And they paid me cash money the first day, cash money the second day. And that Monday, we were able to take the money into my local state tax department to pay for the taxes on the house. Now, mind you, like I said, we had exhausted every option. It was literally the precipice of disaster, and my father pretty much spit in my face and told me no. And now, mind you, he knew I was a responsible person. So, and like I said, I never asked him for anything. So it's not like there was a history of, okay, I gave you this and then you never paid me back. It was none of that. This was the first and only time I ever asked him for anything, and I got to know. So I was like, wow, you know, me. And my wife was kind of nervous because of the way that I talked to my ancestors when I went to the altar. And I'm like, yes, you have a high respect for your ancestors, but there's times when things are happening and the quorum goes out the window because you're just in such an emotional state. You're just trying to, like, just reason this out in your mind how this is not happening and you need it to happen. And that was the state that I was in. And in that state, my ancestors gave me away through this white friend that I had at the time who was a filmmaker, and sometimes he would do work on commercial sets on the side between him making his own movie. And they happened to need extra people, and he called me. And there it is. I had the ability to take care of something that, like I said, and when it comes to taxes here, they put your house up for sale in no time flat if you don't pay your taxes. So it's not a game. And that was the situation I was in. And I was able to talk to my ancestors, and they provided a way out. So there's other stories, but that was one that always stood out to me because I'll never forget how emotional it was and how painful it was, because me and my father always had a tumultuous relationship by the time I hit my teens and to my adult years, and it never, you know, really went back to anything of substance. So in that situation, I was like, wow, you know, this might be something where we can maybe even get closer. He's helping me out, I pay him back, and, you know, things might actually even grow in the positive direction from this, and he completely just knocked that down. So that's just another instance, one of quite a few. But these are just different things that we have the ability to tap into that a lot of us don't even know about, because a lot of the traditions we practice don't really have any practice of ancestral reverence. It's not really ancestral worship. We don't worship our ancestors. What it is that you pay them the same respect as a dignified, as the most dignified member of your family. The one that's what it is. You put them in a special position because of the fact that they have become an ancestor, and the fact that ancestors are more powerful than we are because they're no longer wearing flesh. And in, you know, my spiritual tradition and a lot of the traditional African traditions, your ancestors are your lawyers in the world of the dead. So there's certain gifts that the creator might want to give you, and it's through your ancestors you get those gifts. So the better your relationship with your ancestors, the easier it is for you to access those things that either the ancestors themselves or the creator wants to give to you. And if you don't have those relationships, then there's a legion of people that are related to you that you are severed from. And they do attempt to make contact. It's just that a lot of us don't have the eyes to see because we don't come from traditions that practice ancestral reverence. So the reason why I wanted to go into that discussion is because this is a part of us. And you can be Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Hebrew, whatever the case may be, and still have that relationship if you so choose to build and cultivate that relationship. It does take time, and it does take time for people to understand how the ancestors communicate with you, because everybody has their own relationship with them. So for some people, they might have dreams where they dream about the ancestor, and the ancestor comes to them and provides them wisdom regarding a specific situation that you're having problems with. That happens to my wife quite a bit. Her grandmother will appear to her in a dream and literally sit with her. Like, she'll be like, I'm in the park with my grandmother, and she's sitting next to me talking to me about exactly the problem that I have and how to fix the problem. That's happened to my wife many, many times. For other people, it might be an impression. It might be just a little voice they hear. And from that little voice, they get the wisdom they need to navigate life's issues in the best and most healthy fashion for themselves. But it's about the person being sensitive and in tune enough to understand how that communication is being attempted by the other side. But it's there. And, you know, we're going to get more into it. I'm going to, you know, next week we'll get into, I want to get into specifically ancestral altars and their importance if you're interested, how to actually put one together for yourself. And it doesn't have to be super complex or anything, but it's pretty much a sacred space in your house. And you're inviting your ancestors to pretty much be there with you. In some African cultures, when you passed away, you would be buried under the floor in your house. So that old house of yours becomes an ancestral space and altar in and of itself, where your descendants can come and leave offerings for you and actually talk to you and get your assistance with certain things. In other traditions, they might have a sister, like I know my friend Gus. He's from the Gurune tribe in northeast Ghana, and they build tekken or obelisk when people die in their community. They build an obelisk, they stand, put it up, and then people leave offerings at the foot of that obelisk for that person who's deceased. So each ethnic group has a different tradition, but they pretty much all have some form of ancestral reverence. So we're going to get deeper into this next week, but I wanted to kind of go into that and just give this introduction into it, because I think it's just quite important for us to start to utilize these things. Because from my experience, one of the things that has really helped me to successfully navigate the system of white supremacy is me. This is personal. This is not for me. I'm not suggesting anybody else do it, because it's not for everybody. But when I left Western religion, which was Christianity for me, my family was pretty much Christian, and I was raised Christian early in my life until I was able to move away from that. It was something that never really resonated with me. So I ended up moving away from that. And from that, I moved into the Rasta tradition, because I had a close relative that was a Rasta, so he was the one that kind of initiated me in that direction. And from there, I went on to Kemetic spirituality, which is what I've been practicing for over 23 years. So what I've found is, in practicing these traditions, I've been able to mitigate the system of white supremacy in ways that have been conducive to me not having problems. I'm not living a perfect life, because I get, you know, mistreated like other people. But as far as certain things that are meant for me to have, white folks haven't been able to stop me from having it when it's been, you know, specifically ordained by either the deities or the ancestors that this is mine. There's nothing that is stopping me from attaining that. And when I've gotten readings done from African traditional priests or priestesses, and they give me certain admonitions, as long as I follow their instructions in relation to the situation that I'm asking them about, it always has worked out as long as I did what I was told. And anytime I deviated from the script, it didn't work out the way it was supposed to work out. So this is stuff that I've experienced. This is stuff my son has experienced from a child through his adulthood. My wife, she was Christian, and just from her being with me and the experiences we've had and the things that I've been able to introduce to her and teach her and the people that I've been able to put her in contact with, she even moved away from it herself. And she doesn't really practice any religion, but the one that the form of spirituality that resonates with her the most is the Akan tradition and the Yoruba tradition more than anything else. It's really the Yoruba tradition, or the Orisha, the Ifa tradition of the Yoruba people, I should say. So, you know, it's really something to think about. I'm not saying one is better than the other, because like I said, you create is a personal thing and everybody has their own relationship. So, you know, there was even an Egyptian proverb that talks about that nobody should ever tell another human being about their relationship with their creator. It is a personal thing, and nobody else should encroach on another human being's connection with their creator, whatever path they may choose to get to that creator, even if it's different from yours. And that's the problem with proselytizing. You go into another people and telling them, we think our way is better, and we're going to force you to do things our way. That's insane. Or we're going to tell you our way is better because we're here as missionaries to help you. And the only way to access the goods and services that we're trying to provide you is for you to abandon everything about yourself and pick up this rogue deity that we brought with us that we want to teach you about, which is what the missionaries did on the continent. So, you know, those aspects of Western religion are negative. And the aspects of it where it's used as a tool of mind control over non-white people are negative. But does that mean that the religion itself is actually negative for everyone? Absolutely not. There's people who are Christians who are happy-go-lucky, and their lives may not be perfect, but they're happy with the life they have. There's Muslims, same thing. There's Hebrews or Jews, same thing. So it's not about what's better. It's just about adding another context so that maybe there's other things you can incorporate in your spiritual practice that might give you access to certain things that can help you along the way. Every little bit that we can use will that can help. You know, when you study the revolution in Haiti, it was that vodun, that voodoo practice, that really, really helped set the precedent for their liberation. That's just fact. There's no way for you to study the Haitian Revolution and not get that understanding off the rip, because that's just the fact. When you look at Shaka Zulu and the Battle of Islamwa, the same thing. There was a spiritual context to that battle and how they won it. So it's really about connecting to what belongs to you and utilizing it in a way that's most effective for you today. It's not about telling anybody what to do with their lives. That's your personal life. Who you worship is who you worship. You know, as long as whatever you do doesn't impinge on my life and whatever I do doesn't impinge on your life, we should still be able to coalesce around solving problems. So, did you have any questions, Jenna? Okay, I guess he doesn't have any questions. I don't know if he's if he stepped away. But yeah, I just wanted to actually just say that. And I figure at this point, we'll probably just close out the show. I would like to thank everyone for being with us this Tuesday evening, the 14th of May. And on Real Life, the radio show, we greatly appreciate each and every one of you. We hope that you stay safe and stay out of the hands of slave catchers. And we will see you next week, Creator willing. I'm going to say the prayer and then we'll close out. Creator, we ask that you help us to remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us to remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time that we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Let's replace white supremacy with justice ASAP and also stop human trafficking and end the prison industrial complex. I am in the love of the all, and all love is in me. I am a part of the all, and the all is a part of me. I am one with the all, and the all is one with me. I can succeed as a part of the all and fail as an individual. I can be all that I wish in the all, as long as my wish is to stay in the all. I am never alone. The all is. I am. The all can. I can. The all does. I do. And once again, please do not forget the African proverb. Let it resonate with you. If there are no enemies within, enemies without can do little harm. Let's codify around Black self-respect. And let's codify around helping each other as a collective people. Thank you so much for being with us this evening. It is greatly appreciated. I hope that you learned something. We'll continue this discussion next week. Thanks once again. Peace and love. One love to you, and have a good night. This gentleman might have passed out.